So Numbers 1, when we get into Numbers 1, we're looking at numbering the people. Again, we looked last time, when you think of the book of Numbers, this may be what you think of most. I'm not going to look back at the chart we saw before. There's a lot more in Numbers than just numbering the people. Now, if you're part of the Wednesday night class, David Rafe was talking about Ezra and Nehemiah, and in Ezra, they're numbering the people again. What's one of the benefits of seeing numbers of the people? You think of any? Linda? Okay, yeah, well, it could be kind of a prideful thing, like showing how great we are. David did that, right, in 2 Samuel. He numbers the people, and it was a snare to the people, and God punished the people because of that. So how great is my people? How can I go up against so many? So, yeah. Amos? Kind of the same thing, right? But God is having them number in Numbers 1, number the men of fighting age. So that is part of this. They're getting ready to go in to conquer the land. So that's important. When you read a list of names or numbers of people in the Bible, that's just like super important. And we talked about Wednesday, right? Like how we want to make sure we put some of those verses on our refrigerators, right? So we can memorize those. Those are good memory. Not really. But really, what's the power of seeing lists of names and numbers of people? David?
It's a fulfillment of the promise to Abraham.
Right. Yeah, back in Genesis 12. And really hearkening all the way back to Genesis 1, God promised to bless his people, that they would multiply, they'd be fruitful, fill the earth. And you see that in Exodus 1, Genesis 12, that connection. What else? See a list of names and numbers. Let me ask you this. When you're reading through a list of names, we were talking about mispronouncing names Wednesday. No one was pointing fingers or accusing anybody Wednesday. It's like, there's some difficult names in the Bible. And we may, like, how do you, is it Jehoshaphat or Jehoshaphat or Yehoshaphat? Like, I don't know how to pronounce some of these names. But do you care how people pronounce your name? Lyndon, you care how people pronounce your name? David's been to other countries. He's like, they're going to pronounce it different ways in different countries, right? And Alex, and then other country. What is Alex?
Alejandro.
No, you're not. You're Alexander. You know, but that's just what it is in different countries. But the kind of intentionality and care for this person—that's what we care about. Is we care about, do people care about who I am? And imagine that it was your family name that you were reading in the Bible. Is there any indication that God knows your name? Yeah, there's a book of life, right? And so to think about, these are people that were real people that had real lives that God really cared about. And here are generations later that are reading about these families. And that's their family heritage. That's their family name. So thinking about your identity before God, and God cares about that. God knows who you are. He knows where you came from. He knows where you're going. There's a personal attention to people in the Bible. The Bible's a book of people. It's a book about God, but God's a God who cares and loves for people, right? Now, Numbers 1 just kind of gives us the breakdown of the different tribes. What's the biggest? Oh, David?
And just, I like to associate just that you have these different censuses in the book of Numbers, and I really think this is God getting his people ready to go into the land.
Okay, yeah.
So there's this direction that all of these things that are still at Sinai, a lot of repetition that we have in the first 10 chapters of things that we've already talked about, but this, I see this as kind of this preparing for the promise, getting ready to go in. God's intention is to go in, and he's getting his soldiers ready.
Battle ready.
To go to battle.
Yep. Okay. Now, what's the largest tribe?
Judah's
the largest tribe. We're going to see them numbered as we come through here. They are the biggest. And later when you're thinking about the history of the people of Israel, Judah's always going to kind of stand out. We're going to see it even during David's reign, that the nation kind of becomes divided, comes back together again under David. And then later after Solomon is divided again with Jeroboam in the north and Rehoboam in the south reigning over Judah. Judah's the largest tribe. Which is kind of interesting, thinking about the number of sons Judah has. you think Judah wouldn't be the largest tribe if you go back and read in Genesis, but he is, just by God's providence. Now, the camp is going to be arranged this way in chapter 2. What's the focus of, well, does anybody know what this is? Thank you. Okay, I was hoping somebody would know. So that's the tabernacle. The focus of the camp in the wilderness is God's presence. You know, they're all centering around where God is. And so you've got the most holy place, the holy place, and the courtyard. Now, when you start looking around, and I'm sort of incorporating 2, 3, and 4 as we're looking through this. This is just kind of overview again. We're going to get into chapter 5 and 6 today, and we'll start reading the text more specifically. But in 2, 3, and 4, we get lists of the tribes, how they're headed up. But who's camped right around the tabernacle?
The Levites.
The Levites are camped right around the tabernacle. And there are three clans of the Levites. There's Kohath, Gershon, and Merari. Kohath is going to be camped out on the southern portion. The tabernacle always faces east. Okay, the temple later is going to face east. Do you remember why we're facing east? We're not told, but there's a pattern here. The Garden of Eden. Remember when Adam and Eve leave the garden, and then later Cain goes to wander, he goes further and further east. So to come back to God's presence is like you're going west. So if you enter in from the east, you start heading west, you come into the most holy place in the furthest point. So this is the idea of coming back into God's presence. So Kohath is at the south, Merari is at the north, Gershon is at the west, and then Moses, Aaron, and his sons are toward the east. They're guarding the entrance to the tabernacle. And if you read through this portion here, look at chapter 1, verse 47 through 54. Numbers 1, 47 through 54, the Levites were not listed along with them by their ancestral tribe. For the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Only the tribe of Levi you shall not list, and you shall not take a census of them among the people of Israel, but appoint the Levites over the tabernacle of the testimony, and over all its furnishings, and over all that belongs to it. They are to carry the tabernacle and all its furnishings, and they shall take care of it, and shall camp around the tabernacle. When the tabernacle is to set out, the Levites shall take it down. And when the tabernacle is to be pitched, the Levites shall set it up. And if any outsider comes near, he shall be put to death. The people of Israel shall pitch their tents by their companies, each man in his own camp, each man by his own standard. But the Levites shall camp around the tabernacle of the testimony, so that there may be no wrath on the congregation of the people of Israel. And the Levites shall keep guard over the tabernacle of the testimony. Thus did the people of Israel. They did according to all the Lord commanded Moses." I don't know what the significance of this is. Tabernacle is mentioned 7 times in this section. There's some structure to this that I don't know. So if you want to work on that on your own, crack that nut, get back to me. There's some significance the way this is structured here. But the Levites are tasked with guarding the tabernacle and kind of guarding the people from the tabernacle. So there's this tension in the camp. They want to draw close to God, but how close is close? Not too close. Here's this loving God who wants them close, but you can't get too close lest God would destroy them. And so they're protecting the people from the tabernacle. They're protecting the tabernacle from the people. And Moses, Aaron, and the priests are kind of these watchmen. They are the guards there to keep the people from just wandering in and desecrating the holy place. Okay, so their purpose is to protect this. They're also going to be given charge of moving the tabernacle. We're not going to get into that so much. No, we will. We'll get into that some. And then some more next week. But they're going to be in charge of moving the tabernacle. We'll talk about some things with that later. All right. Now, Judah is going to be with Issachar and Zebulun. These three tribes together number 186,400 for what that's worth. Judah, again, one of the biggest tribes. Issachar and Zebulun are actually some of the smallest tribes. Judah is going to be the kingly tribe. When do we first hear about that? Anybody remember when we first... We blazed past this, I remember. Anybody remember when we first hear about Judah being the kingly tribe? What was that? In Genesis 49, Jacob blesses his 12 sons. And part of that blessing is he talks about the scepter shall not depart from Judah. So even before they become tribes, the idea was that Judah would be the chosen tribe. Reuben had been with Jacob's concubine. Simeon and Levi had been violent at Shechem. The firstborn rights fell to Judah. Now, Joseph is going to be blessed in a different way, we'll see. But Judah is going to be the lead tribe. Issachar and Zebulun are the least of the tribes, but they're lifted up along with Judah, which is kind of a cool idea. The way God arranges the camp is he makes sure that nobody's left out. So you've got the biggest, most powerful, kingly tribe, and then these nothing tribes. God says, you're not nothing. You get to hang out with Judah. So it's kind of cool. Reuben is going to be in the south with Simeon and Gad. And then you've got Ephraim, who's going to be another pretty significantly sized tribe, but he's going to be with Manasseh and Benjamin. Notice anything significant about these tribes being linked together? Yeah, and which sons? Right. Ephraim and Manasseh are the two sons of Joseph, right? Remember, Jacob takes the two sons as his own there in Genesis, and Benjamin. So these are both the only sons of Rachel. They get lumped together. I'm not sure. Yeah, think about if you have two children that get along a lot, they just kind of hang out together. So that, maybe that makes sense. And then the northern section here, you've got Dan with Asher and Naphtali. Now, these four major tribes, Judah, Reuben, Ephraim, and Dan, are all going to have major parts to play in the story going forward. Some of them major failures, but they're still going to have major parts to play. Judah is going to settle in the southernmost portion of the land. Dan eventually is going to be in the most northern portion of the land. Not supposed to be, but that's a whole other story. Now, we talked a little bit about the standards, and if you read through chapter 1, it talks about how each of these tribes be gathered amongst their standards. And listen, I did a lot of research that I just ended up chucking, because to try to nail down, like when you think of a standard, what do you think of? Like, go camp out by the standard, a flag, right? Because we talk about, you know, our army has standards, the Marine Corps has like the anchors and the rope and all that, and the globe. So like, we have different flags and standards. They may have had that, but scholars are still pretty unsure about, was it that kind of standard, or was it just like a stick with different emblems on it? What was it? Without dispute, Judah's standard was what icon, what image? Lyndon? The lion of Judah. And that also comes from Genesis 49. Jacob identifies Judah as a lion. Dan gets identified in Genesis 49 as a serpent. But then later I've read that Judah gets identified as a lion. Dan's not a serpent. Instead, he's an eagle. Reuben is a man. And then Ephraim would be an ox. Does that remind anybody of anything? Right. And because it's in Revelation, it syncs back to Ezekiel chapter 1. You've got the lion, the ox, the man, and the eagle. But I started doing more research on that and found that some of that gets convoluted. And so I threw it out. So the only thing that you can really know for sure is that Judah is the lion. And I hope that helps everybody out somehow. But we do know the lion does have significance, because later Jesus, coming from Judah, he's the lion of the tribe of Judah. So if Judah is the lead tribe, who's the leader of the lead tribe? Ultimately, it's going to be Jesus. He's the king. He's the one who's going to lead the people. And next time, as we look at this, next Sunday, we're going to see even more about how the people start moving through the wilderness. Judah's going to be leading the way. Okay? All right. Questions, thoughts just about the arrangement of the camp? Lynn? Yes.
The priesthood. And
yeah, they're going to lead the way. They're not going to be by themselves leading the way, but yes, they're going to be moving toward the land of Canaan, helping them to cross over. Other thoughts? Some have made a big deal about numbering this. If you were to keep this in strict block formation, what shape does this make? Not a trick question. It makes a cross, right? In fact, it makes a very Latin, like Roman cross. And some of us said, see, even in the camp, people, you know, Jesus, God is pointing to Jesus. I imagine the camp actually was kind of more circular. That's my impression. It just makes more sense because you're trying to get as close as you can to the tabernacle. So it wouldn't have been Judah, another block of Issachar, another block of Zebulun, and then Ephraim, Manasseh, Benjamin. But they're kind of arranged in a rough pattern, is my imagining. So picture the camp more as just this amoeba-like structure, like this blob circular structure. But they're generally in their standard places. That's my inclination. I don't think they're going to keep it strict blob formation for 40 years. But you can fight me on that later if you want to. All right, other thoughts or questions about the arrangement? David?
I guess what you said and what's important about this structure is to see that it is God in the center of life of
right.
all of these tribes. And they're going to be seeing the pillar of cloud and the
right.
pillar of fire every day. He is at the center of their lives and just good application for us as well.
Yeah, again, and we emphasized last week, imagine waking up in the middle of the night and you're scared and you open up your tent flap and there's the pillar of fire with all of its light. Maybe it's sound. I kind of picture sound coming from the pillar of fire, the crackling wind whooshing around this column of flame. The focus being on God's presence, and everyone's going to want to be near that, but not too near. This holiness in our lives is something to protect and to honor, to maintain. Hebrews, the book of Hebrews makes the point that we can now come to him with confidence, with joy, because of what he's accomplished through Jesus. So this shouldn't be like, oh, well, we don't have to do that anymore. Again, it's what a blessing we have that we can draw near to God with confidence without this kind of fear. We don't need priests protecting us from God's presence. We get to be priests in his presence, serving others. All right, other thoughts or questions? All right, yep.
Well, one thing that I did find interesting in chapter 2 is it does specify they shall camp facing the tent of meeting on every side. So it's not just set up your camp and this is your position, but everyone is supposed to be facing inward. They should have been seeing God first thing in the morning and last thing at night.
Right. Yes. And in fact, there are going to be some different ceremonies, things that Aaron and the other priests will be doing. That should have the people facing the tent. Good. All right, let's look a little bit at these three clans of the Levites. In numbering the Levites for service, and this is different. There's numbering the Levites for service and then numbering them for census. We'll talk about census in a little bit. But in numbering them from service, you would number them ages 30 to 50. Now, there's a little bit of a blip in this. Later in chapter 8, if you look at Numbers 8, and verse 24, I don't know quite what to make of this. It does say this applies to Levites from 25 years old and upward. They shall come to duty in the service of the tent of meeting. Now, all through chapter 4, it's 30 years and up. Later at the temple period, it's going to change a little bit. But in the tabernacle period, it's 30 years up and 50. The Septuagint, again, the Greek translation, says 30. So it looks like 8:24 may be a kind of a manuscript blip, just a misreference, not sure. But for our purposes, and just thinking about when did a priest begin his service, it's age 30. And that's helpful because if you're thinking later about some of the prophets and priests coming of age, it's at age 30. Ezekiel 1 begins with Ezekiel, who's a Levite. He's 30 years old, but he's not in Jerusalem. He's not at the temple. He's in captivity. He would have been beginning his priestly service, but he can't because the people have been rebellious and he's in captivity. So 30 to 50, at 50, they would have retired. You know, they're free from their service to the tabernacle. Now, the three clans, again, Kohath, Gershon, and Merari, which is the priestly clan? Which one is the clan? So Levi has three sons, right? Kohath, Gershon, and Merari. Which is the clan that Aaron is from?
Kohath.
And Aaron had four sons, Nadab, Abihu. We know those guys. What happened to them?
They died.
They were burned up in Leviticus 10. But then you have Eleazar and Ithamar. And Eleazar is the next oldest. He's going to be the next high priest. The high priest would get passed down from son to oldest son. But then you have Ithamar. So Eleazar is going to be, he's kind of like the vice president. And isn't the vice president, he's like the president of Congress? Is that kind of the way that works? I'm sorry?
Senate.
The Senate, thank you. The Senate. And the Senate's, yeah. So so he's kind of like the VP. Eleazar is kind of like the vice president here. And so the high priest is over all of the priests. Eleazar is over all the Levites. So the high priest's son, the next high priest, is going to be over all the Levites. And so he's really leading the Kohathites, who are the chiefs of the rest of the Levites. You with me so far? There's a lot of hierarchy happening here, but that's just kind of the structure here. The Kohathites, they're in charge of the furniture. So they're the ones who are carrying the furniture. They've got the poles and everything, right? And so you'll read about how they'll wrap things up. With the Ark of the Covenant, they would actually take the veil down, and the priests are going to do this. The priests are going to do all this function, not the Levites. They're going to take the veil down, walk forward, wrap up the Ark of the Covenant, wrap it up again with fabric, and then ram skin. They're going to secure it and get it ready to go. Same thing with the Table of the Presence, the altar, the golden altar. What's another name for the golden altar? Altar of incense. Remember, all the furniture inside the tabernacle is gold. Outside the tabernacle, bronze altar, right? So the closer you get into God's presence, the more valuable the metals. So they're there in making sure everything's wrapped up, ready to go. The Kohathites are going to be the ones carrying it. And they carry it by hand. Anybody think of a story where that's pretty significant? Carrying the Ark of the Covenant by hand? Uzzah. Yeah, what happens? Right.
Touches the physical
arc. Right, because they are actually carrying it not on the poles like they should be, but this on the ox cart. A new ox cart, mind you, but not the way God said to carry it. So the Kohathites can be responsible for carrying it by hand. Now, there are 2,750 of these guys. Then you've got Gershon, and they carry the curtains. Okay, that's just how I remember it, guys. I'm sorry. Gershon carries the curtains, and Merari Ferrari, like, they've got the heavy horsepower. They have more wagons, more oxen, because they've got more to carry, okay? Some of you guys, like, you won't forget it now. But Merari Ferrari, they need the horsepower, the oxen, to carry the structure. So, remember, the tabernacle is not just a tent. It is a tent over, like, a wooden structure. There are wooden beams or wooden boards with poles and tenons. And so this is really heavy. There's a lot of heavy structure to this. And so they're going to be using carts and oxen to be taking this out. Ithamar, who's the assistant to the high priest, he's going to be the one helping to take care of Gershon and Merari through here. All right? So far, so good? Katie, you good? All right. Those are the priestly tribe. Now, something that happens in chapter 3. In chapter 3, 1 through 39, you've got all of these men who are listed and what they're to do in carrying the tabernacle, making sure everything gets taken care of. But if you look at 38 through 39, those who were to camp before the tabernacle on the east, before the tent of meeting toward the sunrise, were Moses and Aaron and his sons, guarding the sanctuary itself to protect the people of Israel. And any outsider who came near was to be put to death. All those listed among the Levites, whom Moses and Aaron listed at the commandment of the Lord by clans, all the males from a month old and upward, were 22,000. Now, I had 8,500 here. Why are we getting 22,000 here in verse 39? Lynn?
That's the men that were serving, and this is everyone from a month old and upward, right?
Now, notice how different that is in the other tribe. She's right. The Levites are going to be numbered from 1 month old and upward. There's no age to them, essentially. It's 1 month old and upward. Why? The Levites have a very special job as a people. Not just the clans and their roles for the sanctuary, but they have a special job to kind of, they're like the priests amongst the people. So you've got all of Israel, who is a kingdom of priests, and then they are going to be helped by the Levites. The Levites are going to be helped by the priests, so that they can follow God. And so the Levites are numbered 22,000 in total. Now, we had the earlier numbers of all the tribes in chapter 1. We didn't number the Levites there. But now we're numbering the Levites for a different reason. And it's not just the fighting age. It's not the priestly age. Let's look at verse 40. The Lord said to Moses, list all the firstborn males of the people of Israel from a month old and upward, taking the number of their names. And you shall take the Levites for me. I am the Lord. Instead of all the firstborn among the people of Israel and the cattle of the Levites, instead of all the firstborn among the cattle of the people of Israel. So Moses listed all the firstborn among the people of Israel as the Lord commanded him, and all the firstborn males according to the number of names from a month old and upward as listed were 22,273. And the Lord spoke to Moses saying, take the Levites instead of all the firstborn among the people of Israel and the cattle of the Levites instead of their cattle. The Levites shall be mine. I am the Lord. And as the redemption price for the 273 of the firstborn of the people of Israel, over and above the number of the male Levites, you shall take 5 shekels per head. You shall take them according to the shekel of the sanctuary, the shekel of 20 gerahs, and give the money to Aaron and his sons as a redemption price for those who are over. So Moses took the redemption money from those who were over and above those redeemed by the Levites. From the firstborn of the people of Israel, he took the money, 1,365 shekels, by the shekel of the sanctuary, and Moses gave the redemption money to Aaron and his sons, according to the word of the Lord, as the Lord commanded Moses. Okay, we get firstborns being numbered here. What's going on? What's happening with the numbering of the Levites and then this extra money? What's happening? Yes. So God wants to redeem all the firstborn. Now, think culturally here. What's the significance of the firstborn? If the firstborn is lost, then what happens to the family? The idea is the family is lost, right? The firstborn is the heir, the one to carry on the name. That's why back in Egypt, when God killed the firstborn, that was so devastating. It wasn't just we've lost our son, we've lost our brother, but our household is now fallen down. You see that? And so God says, I want you to belong to me, and so I'm going to redeem you by households. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the Levites into my service as a representative of the rest of Israel. But when you do the math, how many Levites are there again? That's the wrong number. That's a different number. 22,000. How many firstborns are there in Israel? 22,273. That was 273. What does God do for the extra 273? There are only 22,000 Levites, but there are 22,273 firstborn. So that's representative of the nation, but these are representative of those firstborn. He's going to take them into his service instead of the firstborn. It's a substitution, okay? God is working off of substitutional value. And he doesn't just skip the 273. What does he do? He takes a payment. Now, there's something significant happening here. I really hope that this sticks with you. God is going to communicate in all kinds of different ways to the Old Testament, this idea of the value of life. And he does it here by payment, redemption. With sacrifice, he does it by life. And so this helps us when we start thinking about Jesus. What is Jesus? He's our substitutionary sacrifice. His life is paid in our stead. So there's a payment, there's a substitutionary life, there's blood, all these different illustrations to help us to understand what God's doing with Jesus at the cross. So it's important for them now to think about the Levites are standing for us. They are representing us before God in service. But later when we get to Jesus and we see him representing us, and how does he do that? With the payment of his blood. How does he do that? With the offering of his life. A number of different ways to think about how God takes care of saving us. All right? So that's what's happening with the Levites here in this section. Elijah?
So with God taking the Levites instead of the firstborn, what happened to back in Exodus where they had to pay to redeem their firstborn? How did those ideas?
Yes. Go? Yeah, again, he's layering on different ideas. And so back then in Exodus 13, he's having the firstborn redeemed so he can initially buy them. Why does he need to buy them? Isn't he just delivering them from slavery? Yeah, but now he's bringing them to himself. So God's doing it in a number of different ways to communicate, you are mine. You belong to me. Okay, it's a good question. All right. Other thoughts or questions about this? I think this is kind of cool. Again, God doesn't say, what's 273? God cares about each individual soul. He's counting heads, just like sheep. You can just kind of picture him taking his sheep and providing for each and every one of them. All right? Thoughts, questions? All right, in our remaining time, what I wanted to do with this class was I wanted to just jump right into chapter 7, 8, and 9, because it kind of fits with what we're doing with the arrangement of the camp and then moving and then traveling in the wilderness. But there's this kind of funny section in 5 through 6. And I thought, well, instead of me being all presumptuous and just rearranging the chapters of the Bible to my liking, let's just walk through it the way the Holy Spirit designed it. So 5 and 6 are in here. And chapter 5 and chapter 6, you've got a test for adultery, and then you've got the Nazirite vow. And it feels to me like it just comes out of nowhere. We're going to later get into chapter 7, and we'll see more instructions about how they're to be traveling. They're going to, you know, offer sacrifices for the tabernacle and then start moving, getting things together to get out. So why do you suppose that is interrupted? So we can talk about a test for adultery and the Nazirite vow. How does this make sense in the flow of Numbers? David?
I think of chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4. All of these are preparing for this trip, preparing for this coming into the land, preparing. We're going into the land. There's this excitement. But God also takes time to say, prepare your hearts.
Yes.
So that's this, especially in chapter 6, and where you're giving yourself in a special way to God. Trying to group it in that way. All of this is preparing for the promise, preparing physically, but also preparing spiritually, preparing hearts.
We're going to see again and again, as the people have trouble complaining and grumbling, rebelling, that God is going to repeat different laws. And it's going to feel like it comes out of nowhere. But it's kind of like a parent with children, and they're just going about their routine, and then the parent pulls a child aside and says, now remember what I said about this. And they start communicating about holiness. Well, the parent might not, but the parent will communicate different rules and ideas, you know, should get ingrained in the child, because what's going on inside the child is going to come out in the way that they're going about their day. And that's what God's doing here with the people. He's saying, remember who you are. Remember what's at the center of the camp is my holy presence. So as you're thinking about moving from place to place, who you are is so important. And so chapter 5 and chapter 6 get thrown in here into this section. That's the only way I can make sense of why this is here. But I'm eager for your ideas if you thought about that some more. All right, let's look at Numbers 5. Numbers 5 is interesting. Verses 1 through 4, God says, here's what you do with leprous people. Put them outside the camp. And they do. They go through that in 1 through 4. But then in 5 through the end, there's this instruction about how you're to deal with an accusation of adultery. Let's just read some. Who's got a clear, strong voice you want to help us out with? I'll go ahead. They have a strong, clear voice. All right. I'll just go ahead and read. You can just kind of track with me here. Verse 5. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel. When a man or woman commits any of the sins that people commit by breaking faith with the Lord, that person realizes his guilt, he shall confess his sin that he's committed, and he shall make full restitution for his wrong, adding a fifth to it, and giving it to him to whom he did the wrong. But if the man has no next of kin to whom restitution may be made for the wrong, the restitution for wrong shall go to the Lord for the priests, in addition to the ram of atonement with which atonement is made for him. And every contribution, all the holy donations of the people of Israel, which they bring to the priest, shall be his. Each one shall keep his holy donations. Whatever anyone gives to the priest shall be his. And so if you've done wrong, you're to not just offer sin sacrifice, but you're to make restoration. But what if you do wrong with something that's hard to restore. Well, look at verse 11. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel, if any man's wife goes astray and breaks faith with him, if a man lies with her sexually, and it is hidden from the eyes of her husband, and she is undetected, though she has defiled herself, and there is no witness against her, since she was not taken in the act, and if the spirit of jealousy comes over him, and he is jealous of his wife who has defiled herself, or if the spirit of jealousy comes over him, and he is jealous of his wife, though she's not defiled herself, then the man shall bring his wife to the priest and bring the offering required of her, a tenth of an ephah of barley flour. He shall pour no oil on it and put no frankincense on it, for it is a grain offering of jealousy, a grain offering of remembrance before iniquity to remembrance. And the priest shall bring her near and set her before the Lord. And the priest shall take holy water in an earthenware vessel and take some of the dust that's on the floor of the tabernacle and put it into the water. And the priest shall set the woman before the Lord and unbind the hair of the woman's head and place in her hands the grain offering of remembrance, which is the grain offering of jealousy. And in his hand the priest shall have the water of bitterness that brings the curse. Then the priest shall make her take an oath, saying, if no man has lain with you, and if you have not turned aside to uncleanness while you are under your husband's authority, be free from this water of bitterness that brings the curse. But if you have gone astray, though you are under your husband's authority, and if you have defiled yourself, and some man other than your husband has lain with you, then let the priest make the woman take the oath of the curse, and say to the woman, the Lord make you a curse and an oath among your people. When the Lord makes your thigh fall away and your body swell, may this water that brings the curse pass into your bowels and make your womb swell and your thigh fall away. And the woman shall say, amen, amen. And the priest shall write these curses in a book and wash them off into the water of bitterness. And he shall make the woman drink the water of bitterness that brings the curse. And the water that brings the curse shall enter into her and cause bitterness and pain. And the priest shall take the grain offering of jealousy out of the woman's hand and shall wave the grain offering before the Lord and bring it to the altar. And the priest shall take a handful of the grain offering, this is memorial portion, burn it on the altar, and afterwards shall make the woman drink the water. And when he has made her drink the water, then if she's defiled herself and has broken faith with her husband, the water that brings the curse shall enter into her and cause bitter pain. And her woman shall swell, her womb shall swell, and her thigh shall fall away, and the woman shall become a curse among her people. But if the woman has not defiled herself and is clean, then she shall be free and shall conceive children. This is the law in cases of jealousy. When a wife, though under her husband's authority, goes astray and defiles herself, or when the spirit of jealousy comes over a man, he is jealous of his wife, then he shall set the woman before the Lord, and the priest shall carry out for her all this law. The man shall be free from iniquity, but the woman shall bear her iniquity. All right. Aren't you glad you came for that this morning? So here's a man, and he thinks his wife has been unfaithful, and he can't prove it. Now, if he'd caught her in the act, or if he had some kind of evidence, then he could present that to the priest. And the priest would be the judges in the land for this. But he can't prove it. So what's he going to do? Just divorce her? Can't divorce her. In fact, in Deuteronomy, Jesus is going to seem to make the point in Deuteronomy that divorce is limited to like actual adultery, even in the Old Testament. So if you can't prove it, what do? Well, you test her. And there's this kind of strange voodoo-y like thing happening here. You read this and you're like, what in the world's going on? There's a sacrifice and there's like a curse written into a book and then it's washed off into the water and she's to drink it. And as she drinks it, if she's guilty, what's going to happen? She's going to be cursed. And then what happens? Her belly's going to swell and her thigh's going to waste away. And I don't even know what that is like, actually, but I imagine she's going to be limping for the rest of her life. And people are going to say, oh, there's the woman of adultery. And then whatever further consequences, what it says at the end in verse 31, that she shall bear her iniquity. Maybe that's just the consequences of this curse. Normally in Leviticus 20, a man and woman found in adultery, what's to happen to them? They'd be killed, executed. So the husband here he's going to be free of consequences. If his wife has committed adultery, he's free of consequences. But if she's committed adultery, she will bear consequences. That's the idea. Now, if she's innocent, she's not committed adultery, then what happens to her when she drinks the potion? Nothing. In fact, she's going to be able to conceive children with her husband. All right. What's going on here? I mean, this is not something that obviously is carried over to the New Testament. So this kind of test for adultery, we're not looking at that. But look, try to look through this strange event and try to perceive what are the principles that God wants his people to understand here. David?
That we can't really escape the consequences of our sin, even if we think no one's seen it, you know. Sooner or later, you know, it will be made known somehow, your iniquity, and, you know, there will be consequences to deal with.
Yeah, be sure your sin will find you out, right? We're going to see that more as we go through Numbers, that God isn't one just to kind of bat an eye at sin. If there's really sin involved, he's going to uncover it. Ecclesiastes ends with this idea. The book of Ecclesiastes, that sin, whether it was public or private, God is going to declare it. Okay? What else? What other principles? Lynn?
Well, I'm just thinking about in connection.
You may have to speak up for.
Verses 5 through 10, where God's talking about being faithful to him.
Yes.
And all of a sudden it gets into a test about, well, you're really concerned about your wife being faithful to you. And so you put her through this test. And it almost seems like he's setting the stage for, look, you're so concerned about a husband and wife's faithfulness. I want you to be concerned about your faithfulness to me. And there are times I am going to test you.
Okay.
In the same way. It seems like okay. That's a correlation.
Okay, so the way that we relate to others should be a reflection of how we relate to God. We care a lot about our relationships here amongst people, friends, marriage. Do we care as much as we do there as we should about God? Yeah, that's certainly under question here. What other principles? What about the husband? Just think about the husband here for a second. He's jealous about his wife. She says, no, 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 I've not done anything. And he just won't let it go. Does he have a right to be jealous if she's committed adultery?
Yes.
Yeah, he has a right to be jealous. I mean, in fact, if he's not jealous, there's a problem. I don't care what our modern society says about marriages and all kinds of relationships. Like, forget it. One man, one woman, Genesis chapter 1 and 2, that's just the way it works. And so if his wife has been unfaithful, he has a right to be jealous. Does he have a right to continue to accuse her, though, without any evidence?
No.
So imagine being the wife and you've not been unfaithful. You've not given him any reason to doubt you, and he keeps accusing you and keeps accusing you. What can you do? Because of this, you can say, okay, let's go. Let's go to the tabernacle, and we're gonna go through this ceremony, and she should clear herself through this. And what does this do for the husband, do you think? Like, socially, for him to put his wife through this? If she's really guilty, then it exalts him, right? But if she's found innocent, what does it do to him? I'm sorry?
Shame.
It shames him. And so is he going to continue with the false accusations? This may seem like a really strange thing that's kind of against the woman here, but I want you to consider what this does for the woman who's really innocent. It provides her a layer of protection from a husband who's just going to continue to be jealous. And it keeps her from falling prey to a controlling, abusive, emotionally abusive husband. It's a wise way, I think, to deal with this that can't be explained through anything but God's wise intervention. So God's protecting the woman here. He's also protecting the man. He's providing for marriage to be viewed in a holy way. Just an interesting way of God dealing with this. All right, other thoughts or questions about this chapter? All right, so I'm not recommending this for present day application, but I will say this, there's an application we made today in this way. Marriage is meant to last in unity. For a husband and a wife to be suspicious of each other, to be bitter toward each other, to be jealous of one another, it becomes a curse, right? It becomes a curse toward each other, toward the family, toward others around them. They're not able to be the blessing that God meant for them to be. And so reading something like this helps me to think about the kind of unity that you're supposed to have in marriage, kind of trust and dependence and faithfulness you're supposed to have in this relationship. And like Lindsay said earlier in the chapter, it's really not just about the husband and wife. It's about their standing before God and their relationship with Him. Okay, we're out of time. We won't get into chapter 6. So maybe you'll have a chance to look at that next time. I think Dave is going to help us out with covering number 6 through wherever you get next time. Thank you. We'll take about a 10-minute break before worship.